Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
It's that most magical time of the year, appropriations arriving 6 months late for the current fiscal year, and Congress futzing over next year's budget, which will also arrive late. Here with his take on what contractors need to do, federal sales and marketing consultant Larry Allen. And this is becoming routine, but how come it somehow doesn't feel routine or correct?
Tom, I think one of the reasons it doesn't feel routine this year is because we were so late in 2023, 2024, getting the numbers for the fiscal year 2024 that it feels like we didn't get any rest. And that's right, we didn't get any rest. We went from 2024 straight into 2025. So we've already got Congress negotiating top-level spending numbers. We've got House and Senate posturing that could change, ironically, in both chambers after the November elections. We have people who are saying that if you want to increase defense spending, that's fine, but we need to really enforce parity with civilian agency spending. And, of course, that's not going to go over well with all lawmakers. So this is kind of, I wouldn't say it's Act 1, but it's, you know, Act 2 of the FY25 circus, and it's time to pay attention.
So contractors really have no recourse other than to follow the leads in terms of the solicitations and calls for task orders that they're getting from government customers.
Well, I think there are a couple things that contractors should do right now, Tom, in preparing for next fiscal year, and that is this week and last week, we've seen a steady drumbeat of administration officials making their way up to Capitol Hill to talk about their FY25 wish lists. And contractors ought to pay attention to what's on those wish lists, because those have a way of making themselves known during the business season for next year. So, you know, you're starting to track those opportunities that are coming down the pike. The other role for contractors is, look, while agencies are beating a steady path to the Hill, there's no reason why contractors can't. While the House might have some restrictions on earmarks, the Senate, at least for right now, does not. And whether you're talking about an earmark or just trying to make sure that your program gets funded beyond this year, you know, it's important for your elected officials to understand just what jobs are at stake in their states and districts.
Yes, because the usual processes of, I guess you would call it, meta-normality are the staff, the senior agency staff, are going to Capitol Hill to talk about their programs, and the congressional staff is generally listening and taking notes and so forth. So they're going through the motions.
Oh, they are going through the motions. I think, of course, the big question mark is the November election, Tom. You know, will either party be able to flip the party, the chamber that's held by the other one right now? Will we have both parties in control of one chamber? We just don't know. But you can certainly put a hypothesis out there that says if one chamber does flip, or ironically, if they both do flip party control, then I think there will be a lot of pressure to kick final FY25 spending decisions to the next Congress. That doesn't convene until January.
We're speaking with Larry Allen, president of Allen Federal Business Partners. Yeah, so right next January in that election, and things tend to get draggy during election years anyway in terms of federal contracting. And I wanted to ask you about your take on the small business numbers. On the surface, it looks like, wow, government has no problem meeting the small business mandate in terms of percentage of contracts and dollars awarded. But that doesn't really tell the full story of the market, though, does it?
Tom, it really doesn't. While it's great news that the federal government for yet another year exceeded its 23% small business prime contracting goal, and not by a little bit, I think you really need to look beyond the numbers if you expect to be able to meet those goals moving forward. And what I mean by that is there's increased specialization in the federal market. If you look at numbers, the numbers recently put out by Bloomberg Government, they talk about the total small business contractor base dropping by about a third over the last 10 fiscal years. A third. That's 33,000 businesses that have net outflowed, small businesses. So when you're trying to bring in companies that are new to the market, who have innovative technology, you're really not doing that. You're rewarding companies that have the specialized infrastructure put in place that they need to comply with all the government rules and regulations. And for all of the talk about people wanting innovative and new businesses, you know, some of the business meetings I've been in, frankly, particularly at DOD, if they don't know who you are, they can be very reluctant to do business with you because you're not tested, you're not proven. So I think while we made good progress this year, there are definitely some storm clouds on the federal small business contract horizon.
And one of the things that doesn't seem to be measured or monitored is, you know, DOD and a lot of agencies run these challenge competitions to get so-called innovative ideas about this or that. It could be a technology, it could be some business process that the agency has, talent management. And yet, I wonder how many of the people that get those challenge grants and prizes, which are small change, basically, ever translate into full-fledged government contracting.
Right. And, you know, we actually have a name for that, Tom. They call it the Valley of Darkness or the Valley of Death, if you want to get really gloomy about it. You know, the people who start off with the innovative grants, some of them maybe CBER Phase 1 type contracts. And then, you know, do they ever make it into actual full open commercial production? Well, not all of them do. And there's been a lot of discussion about how you help contractors in that situation navigate the Valley of Death, but no real great solutions as of yet.
Right. And everybody in DOD knows about the Valley of Death because they refer to it constantly, but there doesn't seem to be any bridges. Or if they are, they're getting hit in the bottom by boats.
Right.
Larry Allen is president of Allen Federal Business Partners. We'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made. And I realized in my own sense, I wasn't listening to very different opinions. And I probably should have, because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been happily married for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.